dilemmas which confront us as we move into various kinds of medical progress. And our guest today, whom we're very pleased to welcome to Concordia Seminary, is Dr. Rocco Lataraca, who works in Cudahy, Wisconsin, and is a member of Mount Olive Lutheran Church in Milwaukee. Doctor, the microphone is yours.
I like that introduction better than Mark Twain, when he was introduced by an attorney who had his hands in his pockets, and Mark Twain said he really enjoyed it, particularly to find an attorney with his hands in his own pockets. Well, I was with Miss Price, and she asked me if I was nervous, and I told her, reminded me, I hope you don't mind, I try not to get scatological about this, but it reminded me of the speaker that was pacing up and down with notes in his hands, which I was doing most of the time, because I had to write these notes last evening, because I am a working pathologist. And some young lady was sitting in a comfortable divan and said, "Are you the speaker?" And he said, "Yes." He said, "Are you nervous?" He said, "No, no." She says, "Then what are you doing in the ladies' room?" So, with that, I will get into the topic. And I had the good fortune to be at your convocation this morning. And I've got to confess, I was to dinner last night, and I with your president, and incidentally, I want to thank them, Dr. Henschke, and also Mr. Whitaker for his kindness in picking me up at the airport. I wouldn't have wanted to walk it all the way over. And I must say that last evening when I went to bed, before I went to bed, I put some notes together on what we had at our conversation. So part of what I wrote is due to your president, incidentally. I think it's very interesting that you have a geneticist as a president. And perhaps we will get into that. But you probably want to know, what does a pathologist do? I think you all think a pathologist is like Quincy. I've seen it once. And that was for a certain reason. And I can't be like Quincy. My wife won't let me. She's a very jealous, irate woman at times. And so I have to practice medicine. And the pathology in my field is the practice of medicine. And I'm a maverick. And the reason I chose is to practice in a small hospital and teach in large universities at both Madison and Milwaukee is because I have the opportunity of seeing people. And one of the impressions I like to give the students, and I think it does perplex them a wee bit, because I like to talk of disorders of patients, is mainly what we at times see in pathology. Now, not in medicine, but in pathology, we see disorders. The disease is from the Anglo-Saxon word dis-ease. And that implies a reaction to a disorder that may occur. Now, I don't know if, as the scriptural readings, if some of those seeds ever fall on fertile ground, I have a sneaking suspicion that they do on occasion. And that is, in essence, what the problem is in medicine. We are dealing with people who have a body, and we won't get into the Aristotelian concept that is the harmonious functioning of the parts that make a man healthy. Because there's more two harmonious functioning of parts that make a man healthy or a woman healthy. If I apologize to the distaff side, I really appreciate them a lot more than the men. But men become so easy to say, and if I do say that, I really mean you people as well. So if I do say men, I beg your forgiveness. I mean each and every man, or person in humanity. Well, there's more to a man than just the parts. There's a function, there's an interaction, there's a rationality. These are things that you don't measure. There's the ability, a potential for growth, continuous growth. Even when we're born in 1920, there's a potential for growth. And I think this is an important definition. Kant, of course, put his finger on it when he described the humanness of individuals, when he said the ability to reason and seek justice. And I think he came close to it than Aristotle. And then, of course, you have the newer generations of people that started to become more mechanistic. And then John Dewey, who's perhaps greatly maligned, but I think he put his finger on it, that there's a totality to man, and that that there's a nature that we have to understand. And in this sense, the practice of medicine is entirely different from studying osteomalacia in hypophosphatemic rats. I don't even know the whole title. I always have to look it up. But in any event, the point I'm getting at is when we deal with people, we are dealing with emotions and we are dealing with other senses. And this is where bioethics or biomedical ethics come in. Now, ethics is the utilization of principles so that there can be harmonious relationship between man and man, or man and society. Now, there are many concepts of ethics that have evolved, and perhaps we should recognize certain key elements in ethics. We have a principle of beneficence. That is, we should try to prevent harm, and we should try to do good. Now, there's a principle of justice. Man towards man, society towards man, it's one society to another society that has to be considered in ethics. And there's also the right of self-determination and autonomy. Now, I would like to point out that there are certain definitions we have to get into. I would like to give you some general discussion on minimal principles of ethics. I must apologize. I am not a philosopher. I am weak in that. I hope that I will, by my talk, encourage you to seek more information in this area. And I think you ought to. I certainly try to keep up with some of these. But there are certain things you've got to know about ethics before we can even go on and discuss. And I will try to keep this at a minimum. But I think we need a certain basic language. We have the so-called non-normative type of ethical decisions or statements. And by that we mean it's when a historian or an anthropologist studies a society and comes up, says, this is how that society behaves. And therefore, this is the rules that they follow. And this is how they get along. Now, if you look in your book of Genesis and Deuteronomy, you'll find that many of your rules that were evolved in that particular manner. What do people do? And it doesn't set a value judgment on anything. And the other non-normative is something that is what I consider a form of sophistry. It started in the mid-19th century, the so-called meta-ethics, where it followed the so-called positive logicians, where they decided to define words. And that's always a nice game. Let's define words, and let's define what we mean by value, and let's define what we mean by these things. And then we have the so-called normative, and that is where we actually set standards. We actually set the norms, the normative ethics. And some say you have to judge something by its act. What has it accomplished? Has it accomplished something good, or has it accomplished something bad? And it's easy if it's all good. It's very easy if it's all bad. But then they say we've got to have the so-called ethical calculus. And that is, we calculate, we weigh the value against the disvalue. Now, this is fine if you're talking in general terms, but I will tell you how we are circumscribed by that. And then you have the so-called deontological type of ethics, where we say it makes no difference whether that act has produced good or has produced bad. What is important is, was that act moral in the first place? Now, I think with such things in mind, I think we have to understand then how we apply certain rules. But we as Christians are a little bit circumscribed. We haven't got that wide, eclectic boundary, you know, and take the best from everything. We are circumscribed by certain principles of our faith. And it's those principles that will form our moral values and our standards, so that we are, in a sense, by our profession of faith, accepting those limitations upon our behavior. Now, in this regard, I cannot argue on, although I will argue with them sometimes on a non-Christian, just to show them, even by their own reasoning, they may have to come, and I will show you an example of that, that they may have to modify their behavior. Now, let us talk one more thing in principle. We describe what we meant by man. The nature of man is more than the parts. It's the ability to interact with other human beings. It's the ability to receive experiences. It's the ability to generate thoughts. It's the ability to be able to communicate such thoughts. And I always like to add the potential to achieve that state. And here I use this because when one talks of abortion, one is aborting a potential. And I was told that you people are all well-versed on abortion, so I shall avoid the term abortion. But we'll get back to it. I managed to sneak it in, because I can't see how we can talk of genetics without talking of aborting. All right, now, if this is what man is to do, then man has a certain right by natural law into achieving this potential and being able to interact. And there are many things that come into this, these rights. Part of it is medical care, and it's only a small part of it. In your particular case, it's spiritual care, and that's part of it. We have people like Aldo Leopold who talk about the ethics, our responsibility, our moral duties towards the environment in which we live. And we talk of legal ethics. I have with me the code of the journalists, very interesting, the newspapermen. They have a sense of ethics. We have become aware of the fact, since the 1960s, that perhaps man has responsibility to man and to the earth in which he lives so that he can achieve all of those potentials. Can anybody living near the Love Canal achieve the potentials we talked about? Or can somebody exposed to a neutron bomb achieve such a potential? Or can a starving individual achieve such a potential? Now, it's rather intriguing to me that when Christ went out among the people, he first healed the sick and then preached. Right there, he saw the unity of the nature of man, or demonstrated it. He knew it. He accepted it. He accepted it willingly. But he, by that action, demonstrates to us that he wants us to recognize that the two, there is no dichotomy At the Sermon on the Mount, the first thing he did was feed the people. Before he even tried to, let's use a new term, behavioral control, which we shall get into, by sermonizing and by teaching. So I would like to point out that all of these things do occur. Now, with all of these occurring, what are the things that we have in ethics? Well, we have duties. That's something that I got a job. You're going to be a minister. You've got to have duties. You're going to be on call. And sometimes the calls, the Lord will try your patience because some people will call you about anything. Everybody gets tried that way. That's the way the Lord does it, I suppose, to make us become humble. We also have obligations which come from a contract. The very fact that you accepted a call, you have an obligation. The very fact that I see a patient, I have an obligation. The very fact that you make a promise, you have an obligation. And then you have the moral duties or the moral values. And where do you get the dilemmas that we're going to talk about? The dilemmas come when your duty is going to conflict with your moral values, when your obligations are going to conflict with your moral values. Now, you're going to say, well, that's simple. But, well, we'll see. Are they as simple as that? Martin Luther, and I understand you have a Department of Church History, and I hope I correct it on it. Maybe I get some information that will clarify it. Was asked by one of the princes, Philip, I think his name was. He had a wife, I guess she was frigid, and he had a mistress. Is that a moral dilemma? Martin Luther had to give an answer to that one. How would you have answered it? I think you ought to go to your history book and find out. Because information handed on a spoon is like pablum. Frequently it's tasteless, but often when you read books, it leads you to thinking to a greater extent. So Martin Luther had numerous moral dilemmas. And you're going to have the moral dilemmas. Perhaps you're starting to notice that what I'm trying to say is my problem are no different than your problems. We are all part of humanity. We shall see the problem from a different angle, from a different set of training, but we will see the same problem of human interplay. Now, what are these problems? Well, let's start out with a topic, any topic. Kyle, you'll even take a suggestion from the floor if you want. I mean, we'll make this like one of these. I'd rather not just stay up here lecturing. First of all, I'm not that erudite. And secondly, I'd rather answer the questions that you have to have. But do you think that is a good place to start? Yeah, right, I think that's a good place to start, no? I had somebody shake his head here, so I assume that that's a good place to start. Now, let me give you a little story. You all have been reading extensively on the definitions of death. How many of you have not? How many of you have? A whole bunch of you. Well, in 1790, they decided, how do you define sudden death? And so you see, I think I slipped back a couple hundred years there right now, about 150 years. And why were they concerned about it? They didn't want to have premature burials. And they were worried about that. Nobody wanted to be buried. Not only that, they were afraid somebody would do them in, too. People are no different then than they're now, when there are estates and there are inheritances. And so there was a French anatomist, Jean-Jacques Winslow. You would never guess that by the last name any more than you would guess that Rockefeller was a Lutheran. But anyhow, Jean-Jacques Winslow had the unpleasant experience of being pronounced dead in youth and waking up in a coffin. Now, that, I think, would shake me, too. And so I think I could understand why Jean-Jacques decided that there had to be a good definition of what was death. And he started thinking about it. How do I pronounce a man dead? Well, he started writing. And there's a lot of writing on this. And he started realizing that there was no sure sign. Somebody at the University of Rome offered 1,500 francs for somebody to give a definition of death. Somebody else offered 20,000 to a layman, I thought this was cute, to give a definition of death, and any physician would get 5,000. Now, I think that's fair. That's what's known as odds. And so, now, they came to the conclusion that it was very difficult to determine when somebody was dead. And so they said a doctor has to pronounce an individual dead because he's the one that's most erudite, a sometimes fallacious conclusion. So they decided at that time that they do this. So in 1877, the United States passed a rule that the only person that could pronounce a patient dead would be a doctor. Now, if anybody knew the state of medicine in 1877 in the United States, knew that that really wasn't making much progress. But in any event, that occurred. Now, if you think this is facetious, how many of you have read that on the way down to the autopsy room, the sheet started to move, and the person that was pushing the cart had a very unpleasant physiological action, and had to bring the patient back. These have occurred within my lifetime, within the last 10 years. Now, the Germans, being as meticulous as they were, and I've got to be careful, I'm outnumbered, I should imagine, although my son once said to me, Dad, he said, you know, we're really a minority, Lutheran Italians. And I said, son, I says, I've got them outnumbered. But in any event, they're very meticulous. So they decided to have a mortuary. And they put gloves on these people. They put them in windows, you know, they have where they can watch them. And you can see, one of the definitions where the best definition was that, I got to deviate here, was that decay was the best definition of death. Now, I will admit it's good, but it's believe it or not, that was the definition. Everybody agreed until some people said that we should have better signs. And by the way, one of your reasons for weights is exactly that, to determine whether death has occurred. Well, anyhow, they figured, and I want to see if this is familiar to you. So in the 1890s, they rigged up little doohickeys that they would attach to fingers so alarms would go off if there was a wiggle. Does that sound familiar to you? Have any of you been in an intensive care unit? Do they have alarms that go off? So here you have an alarm that went off, so you prevent premature burial. Now we have an alarm that goes off in the intensive care unit. So the definition of death has eluded us. Well, it was relatively simple when we said the heart stopped, the respiration stopped, and therefore the patient was dead. And then came modern technology. And modern technology is able to keep the heart going, the lung going. They can keep circulation going by many ways. And then they said, well, now we have to get a better definition. And the good Lord made Harvard, and Harvard convened, and they said, they came up with a definition that we have to have brain death. And what we have to do is to get electroencephalogram. An electroencephalogram measures the potentials that generate, every living cell generates a potential. Well, it's interesting that that's from the neocortex, that is a part in the higher animal, the cortex, and then it sends messages down to lower centers, which are also important, but it measures only that. The lower centers can still be alive, but everybody missed the point. The point, as far as I am concerned, is this. If somebody has. See, we just transferred the definition of death from the heart and lung to a brain by a physiological measurement. But what is the measurement that we've got to have? How have we defined humanity? The ability to interact, to mentate, to communicate. When these are gone, my question, and I will not answer it for you, my question is, do you have a human being? Is this life, as we know it, in the sense of the nature of man? Now, this is entirely different as the nature of life as the viability of a cell. Do you have a man? My answer to that, I think one should not be too obtuse in this audience to realize how you think I would answer it. I feel that if one cannot have these essentials, these essence of mankind, one does not have a man. One has a living organism. Then came the question, do we have the right to cause cessation? What are the problems? Well, the problems, what are the moral problems? Well, the moral problems are the following. Is somebody going to pronounce the patient dead? Now, notice that there's the corollary between 1890, et cetera, and the mid-1800s, between that and this. Are we going to pronounce a man dead before he really is dead, when we really aren't sure whether he's going to get that communicating faculty back, so we can take a heart or a liver or a kidney or skin or bone? In other words, are we going to pronounce somebody dead for our need, thereby doing harm to someone who potentially has the ability to be revived? People have had coma for long periods of time and have come back functioning. Now, perhaps they don't function as well, but they still have value in their functioning. The other thing is, can somebody then say, hey, you know, we've got a beautiful preparation. You know, antibodies are very difficult to come by. And here we have an intact body that we are keeping alive. Can we induce antibody formation and make all the serum we want? And antibodies made in the human are going to be more specific for what we would want. Now, are we going to keep our people alive? And by the way, this has been done for 3 and 4 and 5 days to anguish to family, and harm now is being done to a segment of society, so that we can wait for the proper recipient. And if we decide that we're going to do this, how are we to do this? Do we need the consent of the family? And then how is it to be paid for? These are your moral dilemmas. And you see where your problems lie. Yes, that kidney could be good for another person. And we do have the HLA typing, certain types, so it won't be rejected. And somebody in California needs that kidney. But who's going to pay for that patient staying alive? Or while we wait for somebody, you know, or something, how are we going to keep them? Society has an interest in it because the cost of care is going up. Now, you may say those are ridiculous things. But as Hans Jonas said, the very fact that I can think of the problem makes the problem a reality. And as Reinhold Niebuhr said, man likes democracy, in essence. I may not be quoting him correctly, but it's man's injustice that makes democracy necessary, the importance of it. And this is why we, as a society, and as a group, this isn't only for ministerial or physicians. These are problems that must be answered by everyone. Medicine as a science can only give us ends. The use of the ends are the responsibility of the realms outside of science, in which we as scientists are part of a larger segment. Now that handles that. Now I think we can go to euthanasia, I think, because it's pretty close to death somewhere along the line. And what's euthanasia? Well, I was told in Greek, I'm not a Greek scholar, I do not have the benefit most of you have had, and I regret it, of a good classical background and education. And I really mean that. I think it's rather important because many of these problems have faced people over the years. And it's remarkable how we are always rediscovering an old dilemma with a new face. All right. Do I have a right, when I have a very severe illness, to say, cut that out? I don't want a tube in my throat. And I don't want to go through all of this agony for any purpose. I have lived my life. I will not be useful. I shall be a burden to my family. Please cut out the nonsense and let me die a normal death. Now, it would almost seem that this is a reasonable thing to do. Yet, there are modern philosophers that argue that no one has the right to do this. And they equate the physician that accedes to such demands is actually morally wrong, as if he were abetting the death by a positive action. They claim no action is an action. And since natural law says that man shall live, one is then going against natural law. Well, I think the fallacy in this, and here I am doing something I should not be doing, I'm going to give you an answer, which I would like to have you know can be totally refuted, and perhaps in a very logical way by others. Because moral dilemmas are just that. There may be two answers. One may be more correct than others. If that's true, reason will bring it out. But there may be answers that are borderline, and a decision has to be made. Now, I say I am of my free will making that. And I have the right as a human being to autonomy, to self-determination. And I would like to die a natural death. When Christ died on the cross, he said, "Thy will be done." And I choose to do the same thing as a Christian. Yet, there may be putting a doctor in a legal obligation, because the doctor has a contractual arrangement with a patient to do no harm. Now, I don't believe harm is done when a natural course of an illness is allowed to proceed. And yet, there are many. Camisar, for example, an excellent philosopher, will say, first of all, that may be wrong. Medical knowledge is not that infallible, and that's true. Secondly, when somebody is in a very emotional state, is he in a state that can actually give consent, a good consent, a volitional consent that's unimpeded by any pressures? So that's the other problem. And so Camisar says no. Now, this is the dilemma. How do you accept that? The answers are very simple. See, you can sit down and argue emotionally. And emotional arguments, as you get into these, often lead to nowhere. What we need are rational arguments based on principle. And as I said, we're circumscribed by Christian principles. I think that the answers to that are easy. Now, whether a doctor actively participates in it, I think is wrong. Now, some people would say, well, you're wrong, because an active participation will relieve the suffering. And if the patient said, yes, I want you to do it, he's got free will. But my role as a physician is not to accede to that wish, because my role is to do no harm, where possible, not to do any harm. And therefore, I would be violating, there's my dilemma, I would recognize that the patient might have less suffering, but I also would recognize that I have a moral obligation by natural law that life is very important and that life should be respected. If I violate it this time, when will my barrier break down the next time, and the next time, and the next time, and the next time? Will my standards become less and less and less? So that I think a certain rigidity in that regard must remain. Now, I think moral euthanasia has had a dirty name. I think we've got to separate what we're talking about. The will to live is one thing. The wish to die is another, if it's based on good, sound judgment, and I think the self-determination. I think these are important things. Does it constitute murder in those particular cases? Now, the incompetence is something different. There's your problem. There's the rub, the incompetence. Who takes care of the child who certainly hasn't reached the stage of reasoning that can make that decision? Does the parent have a right to make that decision? What about the elderly that have become senile? You know, there's a form of life there, and there's a sanctity into that life. The value of that life can't be judged by you and me. There is a value to life. The incompetent must be protected by us. We cannot make decisions for incompetence unless we know what kind of a decision is it. I think when you're dealing with an elderly, very elderly, I think the exception is when you know that it is a totally terminal and you have absolute evidence of this. It's a totally terminal condition. Then I think when the wishes of the family say, look, let Dad die comfortably. I think that is a very good wish. I had to make that decision. I had to make that decision to my mother. It wasn't pleasant. My mother was very sharp until she was 90, 90 and a half, and suddenly became quite senile and totally crumbled as far as the ability to know where she was, who she was, and know anything. She broke a hip. And you know, fractures in hips used to be a blessing at one time. But we had the methods of not making her be in pain by putting in a prosthesis, which we did, because she was in good shape. So we put a prosthesis in so she would not have the pain. So we knew she'd never walk again. But now she was totally bedridden, disoriented, didn't recognize anybody. And she was a very, very healthy woman. Well, I sat with my sisters and my brother, and my decision was, yes, we are not going to do anything that's going to be harmful to her, but we're not going to put her in an intensive care unit either. We're going to treat what we can in the most minimal of manners, because I think death is part of life, and it's part that each and every one of us have got to face and got to live. It's part of our life. If we have an eternal life, we either believe it or we don't believe it. We don't prolong dying. It's not the equivalent of saving a life. So these are the things that one has got to face, and you've got to face that. Now, we can stay.
Kind of right here. I was just wondering, from a legal aspect or anything, if it's becoming a fad or something that has been discussed, we have wills for what is done with the person's possessions after he dies. In this case, with euthanasia.
Living will. Yeah, I want to avoid it because I was told, I have a little saying here that more souls are lost by a long sermon than are lost by the passions of youth and spring. And I want to keep this down. So I didn't want to get into all of that. And I think one can make themselves, if I want to cover the ground I would like to get to a few more interesting. See, I'm getting up to the more interesting parts, I think. All right, now, where should we go from here? I put notes together, and I'll just deal my cards out. And I think I covered that one, Oh, yeah, we got genetics, medical confidentiality, allocation of resources, and experimentation. Let's get to genetics. Since we have a president here that probably can teach me more about genetics than I can teach him. And I think that's very good, and I think you people ought to take advantage of it. And I think you should, because this is the field that you're going to be plagued with. Let's start out with simple things. A woman's pregnant. And now, in pregnancy, we can do certain tests. A needle can be inserted into that uterus and some fluid be aspirated. And when you aspirate that fluid, you accumulate cells. And you accumulate cells, I can't see it over there. You accumulate cells, and then from those cells you can put them in cell culture. And Lord, what you can do with those. You can find out what kind of enzymatic defects there are. Okay? And then you can find out, is it a boy or is it a girl? You don't have to guess anymore. Okay? So now you know it's a boy or a girl. And you have some ideas that there are going to be some deficiencies. Where do you go from there? I don't want a boy. I've got all boys. I want a girl for my wife. Well, is that a reason for termination of a pregnancy? Now, I said I'd sneak something in on you. Since you've all have had discussions on abortion, see if I've given you the reasons for and against it properly. Life begins at conception, right? Every life has a right to come to a termination and lead its own destination. Is that correct, basically, on the one side? The opposite side, says life doesn't begin until quickening, a baby's not human, because it really doesn't react, and the mother's got a right to do with her body what she chooses. Are those pretty much valid? Am I being fair? Good. I've given you no argument that was given later than 250 B.C. when the Pythagoreans were arguing with the Epicureans about this. As you know, the Greeks practiced a lot of this. So you see, we really haven't come a long way. Maybe they have with cigarettes, baby, they came a long way. But we haven't come a long way with that moral problem. So we're back where we started from. So you see, we're back at the problem. I just wanted to show you a knowledge of going back to history is fun. You ought to know more about it. And if you know more about it, one, you'll be less cocky. Two, you won't make the same mistake, I don't think. Three, you may make the same mistake because you think you're smarter. But in any event, now that you know this, does the woman have a right to abort? Well, the Supreme Court says yes. Yet I, as a Christian, say no. Because as I defined the nature of a human being, I didn't say no. Because as I defined the nature of a human being, I said the potential to achieve the others. Now people may say, well, Rock, you're crazy. And they may be correct. And so that is the other thing. You have genetic problems. That becomes a little bit more complicated. A child with Tay-Sachs disease, a child with PKU, even though you can get on diets, can disrupt the whole household. It can make life miserable. There can be tremendous problems, and yet, to every life, there is a value. The economists can tell us the cost or the price of taking care of that child, but the economists can put the price on it, but they can't put the value on it. So there's your dilemma. What do you believe in? Okay, that comes under genetic counseling. We'll get into that too in procreation. And, of course, you put your finger on the moral dilemma, haven't you? As I said when I accepted the invitation, I'm coming up with questions. I don't think I'm going to come up with many answers. And I think the answers have to be developed by you people. You're going to be part of that. Someday you're going to be called in on that decision making. As a pastor, you're going to be called in on it. As another human being, you're going to be called in on it. I know families with 3 mongoloids. Now, was it right that they had 3? I don't know, but they're raising all 3. They have set a value on those children. Are all mongoloids difficult to deal with? You see? And the question comes up, these are the problems. You put your finger exactly on the problem, but there is such a thing as genetic counseling. What was the cause? Can it be determined, you see? And some of these can be avoided. And there is things called adoption that we can get into, which I would like to get into on that. All right, now we've got that. I gave you those problems. I didn't give you many answers, you noticed, because I don't know some of those answers, and some of those answers are going to require a lot of Christian thought, because I don't think we ought to be ashamed of having a Christian thought on a certain thing, and I'll get into that a little later. Now comes the other interesting one. A couple want a baby, and they can't have one. And have you read about surrogate mothers? When did you read yours last about surrogate mothers? Soap operas. Anybody else? Anybody know about Abraham and Hagar? I hate to do this to you kids, but I'm not a theologian. But I think that was the first evidence. And were there any problems? And have there been any problems recently in the newspapers with surrogate mothers? Identical to Abraham. Abraham's wife said, Hagar's pushing me out of my own house. Right? I think he said that, am I right? I mean, you're the practical theologian, right? I'm just an earthen vessel that came here. But in any event, those are the problems. How do you go about a surrogate? A surrogate wife, that creates awful difficult problems of inheritance. Does the child have a right later on? You can't wave the child's rights away. Not morally. Kid has an ethical right. He's got a moral right as a human being to know who his parents are. And that's been upheld by the courts. And even lately it's in the genetic counseling. And also the inheritances come in. Well, then people said, we're going to avoid that one. We got better ways of doing it, fellas. We'll get sperm banks, and we'll get pooled, and we'll do some artificial insemination. Now, that's simple. So you don't let the mother know who the father is, and the doctor says, I'll take a history, I'll make sure there's no mental disorders, I'll make sure, and he takes a history. And the average history taken by a doctor is often about quite weak. And certainly when it comes to genetics, most doctors are not trained. And I certainly, for one, recognize my shortcomings in genetics. But I wouldn't want to do a genetic history. Now, if a fellow is interested just in inseminating somebody, he goes out and says, "How is your father, Joe, and how is your mother? They're okay. How are your brothers? They're okay." Because, you know, the brother could probably be, you know, have two heads or three hands or something like that. Or he failed to remember this. And, you know, so the kid, they do this and they inseminate that and the woman has a child. Now, who's the father of that child? Now, you can have all the papers in the world you want, agreeing to everything. But now, if a child that's adopted has the right to go to a court and say, "I want to know who my true parents were," the courts have now stated that they must get that information before genetic reasons. Now, a child finds out he was born by artificial insemination. Does that child have the same right to claim that information? I believe he does. And I think a child, if he's interested in this, has that right. Now, we get, you say, far away from the thing. What makes the father is not whose sperm fertilized that ovum. It's the love, the upbringing, and I'll grant all of that. That is the important part of being a father and a parent. Is the love that one gives a child, the nourishment in growing up, not only the nourishment in food, but the nourishment in the spirituality, the nourishment in the understanding of life. But there are legal questions. The kid says, "Yeah, you gave me all of that. I want to know what my genes are." Now comes the big perplexing problem. I think these doctors are going to be in difficulty. Once these kids get to be 18, they've got 2 years beyond the age of 18 before the statute of limitation runs out. And particularly if they should suddenly start breeding children that are not normal. Somebody could say it's caused me painful harm, you know, and all of that sort of stuff, and you can collect money for that. So that comes to bear, there's the problem. And what the child's right. So some people say, well, we won't reveal the names, but some people are required to do this. How many times will you accept a sperm from one individual? Is another good question. Can you imagine a community if somebody has donated 15 or 20 and this has happened? There's consanguinity going on. Can there be mating then between siblings? And this is a problem. And shall there be a limit to this? This is a moral problem. Do I absolve myself of revealing the parent if I mix three sperm pools? Okay? Well, then the answer to that is, I don't think you do it. You just have to come up and say, you're going to have to do some HLA typing, because now if you give me the names of the three fellas, the chances are with new genetic techniques, we can tell which of the three were responsible for that baby. So I don't think you're really doing anything. But is this a problem? Now, you say, well, this isn't going to happen. Well, I thought about it. Some lawyer sure thinks about it. Comes the next problem, then let's get away from that. We don't have to do this. Let's fertilize an egg, either in a woman's uterus, take it out and implant it in another uterus. That can be done, it's done with cattle. Or let's take a test tube. This is known as ectogenesis. You know, you've got to create a new word for everything you do. And this means outside, you know, the ordinary. So you can either develop this and get this, the blastocyst forming, and insert this in the uterus and let carry this to term. We've read about this. And what's good about it, it doesn't take as many sperm cells. Required, the husband that has a very low sperm count can then cause a fertilization. Unfortunately, nature has some very good things. God, when he created the body, did it without a committee and therefore did a very nice job. By the time very peculiar sperm cells, you know, some of them just can't make it. And they just die off somewhere in the vagina, maybe right near the endocervix or something, and they'll never reach the fallopian tube. So the poor sperm cells, the inadequate ones, will never make it to fertilize. But in a test tube, Lord, you've gotten rid of that obstacle. Now what can come out of that? You can even have double fertilization. You can get monstrosities. Oh, you can even determine whether this is going to be a boy or a girl. And you can say, well, I'm going to just throw the test tube down the drain. Again, you got a potential. And then you've got that problem. And so the problem comes up. Now, I can take, with this, I can take the eggs of the kind of women I want to breed, because I know they're good, my moral values or my value judgment. And I can take the man, and I know his sperm is good, my value judgment. I can fertilize eggs, and I can give them to women. Okay? Incidentally, a Nobel Prize winner has suggested that all the Nobel Prize winners contribute their sperm. And Hans Müller did this, and Shockley, who shocks a lot of people, has contributed some of his sperm. And the idea is that we're going to breed a new race of men, etc. That's a frightening thought. C.S. Lewis talks about the dehumanization of mankind. This is part of it. We have within our hands the ability to clone. Clone means like a twig in Greek. You can take a twig off a tree, put it in, it takes roots. And then you got the tree that's just like the other tree, see? Now, you may think cloning is far away, but it isn't. They've done this already. You can take a cell from a being, an animal. And by the way, it's not very difficult anymore. And you take the ova or another cell of a patient, of a person. You take the genetic material out of the from the cell that you want, what you want the individual to be like. You take the nucleus, which has the chromatin, which carries the genes. Take another cell, take out the nucleus, and insert that nucleus in there, and you can develop things. At first they were having little problems, but they've overcome some of those problems. And now they've carried, even last year in science, 3 mice were cloned. Now, it won't be long before the cloning is attempted in individuals. Now the question comes up, is cloning good? Is this a dehumanization of mankind? Is it nice to have replicas? Can you imagine this room when everybody looked alike? Everybody had basically the same thought. What a sterile society and what a sterile environment. What is there in our definition of humanity for experience? We already know what we're going to experience. We're going to think alike. We're going to do alike. In most cases, with some minor variations. So the question comes up, is this an area that you should be concerned with? And that does there reach a point in society when society, when we in a society have sufficient knowledge of our basic philosophical concepts that we ought to say that there are certain things that aren't good. Let's take cloning. How many of you lived in a town with a lot of elm trees? Remember how beautiful those elm trees were with those beautiful shapes? Every street looked alike, and as you walked down in the summer, it was like going down a cathedral. And with the sun shining through, and every so often the beams of light coming down, what a beautiful sight it was, until the fungus got it. You know, the good Lord may have had a point at random selection of genes, because we really and truly at conception are neither father nor mother, but we have our own identity. We are something special in nature. We are something created, that there will never be another one like us. There never was one like us before, and there never will be another one like us again. We are something special at conception. We have taken that away. Now, last night we were discussing a few things. We talked about using science for the benefit of mankind. Francis Bacon, the great philosopher and thinker of the Middle Ages, said, "Man shall understand nature for the betterment of man, to relieve him of all of his obstacles." And I'm sure Francis Bacon had very good, legitimate beliefs in that. But C.S. Lewis also said, man uses nature for his own end. He uses natural means to control other human beings. And this is part of what he meant by the dehumanization of mankind. And this is a moral dilemma. Where do we go? Where does our experimentation go? Now, once you go farther on in genetics with other problems, we should probably move on to the field of experimentation. Everybody was shocked when they found out that some black people in Alabama were not treated for syphilis. The Center for Disease Control decided to use them as controls. They wanted to see what happened. That was really a horrible. It was an experiment, poorly planned, poorly thought out. It had no place. 25 or so black men who could have been treated for syphilis, because we did have therapies for syphilis, to determine whether how many would reach the ravages of syphilis. Well, all they had to do was read books. And they didn't have to go and say, "I want to know by my own means." They had to read a book. That was harm as far as the medical community was concerned. Or how about in Brooklyn, when they injected cancer cells into dying patients to see what would happen without their understanding. By the way, neither one of these people had given permission for this, you know, either group. Well, we were horrified during World War II with the experiments carried out in the Nazi prison camps, and as a result, the Nuremberg Code came that you shouldn't do harm, everybody should know what's being done to their body, and therefore, a consent must be given. This was modified by the World Health Organization in Helsinki in 1956. The code became a little bit less stringent, but I think it was also quite good in controlling things. But experiments are very important. There are several kinds of experiments, two kinds that I'd like to talk about, therapeutic and non-therapeutic. A therapeutic is when the patient may benefit from the care, and so will all the other people coming thereafter. And a non-therapeutic is for the acquisition of knowledge. Now, both of these are good if conducted properly. If the consent is given, the patient knows exactly what is going on. The patient has a right to desist and put an end to that experiment when the patient thinks that they've had enough. Now, you might say, why do we need all of this? Well, we have controlled experiments And we learned that the doctors weren't that smart. They learned that from the people in agriculture. The people in agriculture ran the controlled experiments, and that's where they learned about it in medicine. Now, what do you do in a controlled experiment? In a controlled experiment, you take a certain group of people, and you say, one half will get this treatment that we're going to try out, the other half will not. They'll get a placebo, something that they won't know what it is. And what you do is a double-blind experiment, so you don't influence the doctor, because, you know, some doctors are very enthusiastic, and they can spread their enthusiasm to the patient. And I think, in most cases, that's what cures the patient. I don't think it's the medication. So you have to get rid of that, and you do what they call a double-blind study. Some statistician randomizes the patients as they come in and says, patient A will get this. The only people that will know this are the people that are going to give out the medication. The doctors will make observations, and they'll centralize the data. Now, you might say this is wrong, because you're lying to one half of the patients. And on the other hand, if you told the patients you're getting the placebo, well, you screwed the experiment up right there. So you can't do that either. So the question is, do you take all the people, say half of you are going to get it and half of you aren't? We're going to soon find out. Now, if no harm or very little harm can come, or if you can interrupt that experiment where harm is starting to come and then immediately intercede, there's nothing wrong and that will be acceptable. And that, of course, they want rules of committees in these experiments. And you have to, by the way, meet very stringent rules, both if it's federally granted and particularly, you have to get very stringent requirements on your grant. And also the institutions are held responsible for that activity. Now, in these cases, a therapeutic trial may be of value. Now, there may be cases you may question. The beta blockers that they gave for coronary artery disease. Now, 43 people died, and the others were alive, and you said, well, geez, we have to wait for 43 people. Well, the statisticians have to tell you when that experiment's complete. But let me just tell you that there are many treatments that have been put into vogue that are totally useless. And there are many medications that are more harmful that are used. And if one uses this double-blind study, one may prevent unnecessary harm. The coronary bypass, for example. There really hasn't been a very good double-blind study on coronary bypass. Indeed, the old days, they used to implant the mammary artery. That's the artery that runs right behind your chest, put it in the heart, and said that, oh, that's making the patient very good. Somebody said in Seattle, you know, I wonder if that's working. So they took half the patients, and half of them got the mammary artery put into the muscle. They didn't even put it in, they just put it in the muscle. And the other half, they just made a nick over the skin so the patient thought they had it. And they both did the same. Now, the question, the moral dilemma is there. Did they lie to that second group? And yet information was given that was very important. Now, did they give the consent for that? Yes, they gave consent for an operation. Was there a violation of a trust? And yet, look what happened. You got rid of an operation that was totally useless. See, once a procedure is started, it's very difficult to eradicate, which made Oliver Wendell Holmes tell his medical students that if the United States pharmacopoeia were ever thrown in the ocean, it would be good for the patients but bad for the fish. And he meant it, because many of the treatments were terrible, and they still are. Some of your antibiotics that were used and some of your other things are of no value. But the point is, how will advances be made? Some people feel experimentation is important under controlled conditions, but it has to be with consent. Now the rub comes. Can you use prisoners? Can you use minors? Can you use mental incompetence? Are those really consents given under free will? these become problems. Can a parent really consent for a child? Well, people have stated that we are living because of the experiments of other people that have given us the heritage, the endowment, for us to go on and have a good, fruitful life, because our body is kept together by this knowledge, and therefore we are obligated to future generations to contribute to our experiments. Hans Jonas, on the other hand, said, we owe a debt of gratitude to those people, but we have no obligation. Now, Hans Jonas is a pretty good thinker, and he brings up a point that I think should be considered. But when it comes to the child, you've got to have experiments on child, because children, because their enzyme capacities are different, they don't handle drugs the same as an adult. And how do you determine? If experiments hadn't been carried out at the National Institutes of Health on acute childhood leukemia, every childhood leukemia would have a 100% mortality. Now, childhood leukemia carries with it an excellent chance of survival because of the experiment that took place. The question comes up, though, how do you get that consent? The question comes up, can you use a cadaver? Can you use a fetus, by the way, that's being aborted? Does a mother who wants an abortion have the right to give a consent on what she doesn't want? If on the one hand I want to destroy something, do I have the right then to have a legal consent? I don't know what the answer to that moral dilemma is. And now briefly I'd like to talk about the so-called distribution and allocation of health. We talk about rights to medicine, and we talk about the cost of medical care. Is there a conflict for a doctor when he sees a patient, and when that patient sees him, or that patient goes to the hospital, that patient is saying, I am coming to you because I want my health restored. If society says it costs too much to restore your health, is the physician an agent for the patient, or is he an agent for the fiscal agent? To me, the answer is simple. He's an agent for the patient. If he cannot be, then he should not take on that case. Is there a moral dilemma when we say we want, you know, there are a lot of very fancy terms that we can write under the banner. Quality care at the least cost, at the most affordable cost. Now, boy, I can go, that's like apple pie, motherhood, flag, everything. What do we mean by quality? What do we mean by care? What do we mean by affordable? And who's to make those decisions? We healthy people? Or are we going to take some of the sick people to make that decision? I have an idea that the economist who sits behind his computer and figures out the price of that, when he gets sick, will somehow like overlook that computer printout and say, boy, I want that kidney, and yet we don't have enough kidneys or dialysis machines. Question is, what can we afford? And then, of course, I overlooked the most important part, that health care is much broader. It's got to do, you know, there's no sense keeping a patient alive and having them go out in a society that starves them with unfair economic means. Now, is that medical? Is that societal? And these are the problems. And then there's a sense of confidentiality, of which you will be part of. Well, you want your history and physical on a computer. We're seeing so many doctors, and each and every one is putting your data down. And it's, as more people enter data, more errors can be made, and that data can be there forever. And they say, well, nobody has access to this information, but. Well, let's see what happened in England. They did a genetic study, and they put a lot of data on a computer, promised everybody it would be confidential. But what did the bureaucrats say? This will allow us to be able to determine which children will fare best with a good education. That's a horrible thing, as far as I'm concerned. Poor Thomas Aquinas used to be called Lassino. That means the jackass. His colleagues didn't think too highly of him in his own monastery, but look at what Thomas Aquinas accomplished. And look at Van Gogh, you know. I can go down the line. And another thing, too, do I want my history to be used that way? Oh, I forgot to tell you what happened in England. After this was sent in, 150 former nurses were contacted and wanted to know why they gave up the practice of nursing. This is on a confidential computer. Now, I have the right to go to church, and as a Christian, I know that each and every day I transgress, and I have the right to seek forgiveness for my sins. And with God's grace, I hope I get that forgiveness. But who forgives me on that computer? And these are the moral problems we are going to have. Stockholm decides that they're going to have three levels of access to that computer. A minimal access, a intermediate access, and a very highly selective access. Well, if I'm a dictator, I'd fall into the latter group. These are the problems you're going to face. And someday you're going to get into pastoral care. And I'd love to touch on this one at this particular time, because now it's become very structured in hospitals. I remember when a chaplain in a hospital used to go around and talk to people and really did a lot of good. But now we're structured. They even have conferences. Every day, I know at our hospital, and I know at a couple of other hospitals in town, you can't get the chaplain because they're in conference discussing cases. Now, I'll be darned if I tell you something as a minister, if I want you to go and tell Sister Mary or Father Joe about my transgressions. And I don't think there's room for this type of pastoral care. And I think that's the moral dilemma when it comes to the care of the patient. I still think that's under medicine. I think it's under medicine, because the spirituality of a human is also being cared for in a hospital. Well, I hope I didn't babble like an old man. I don't think I'm old. When I die, my epitaph is going to be, he died a premature death. I didn't come here to give you any answers either, but I did come here with the hopes that you would be stimulated to understand ethics, to understand a humanities. It's unfortunate that the humanities programs in the colleges that were so prevalent in the 1700s and 1800s were gradually diluted out with the rise of science, because people got to the point where they could measure things. And anything that they couldn't measure was not worth knowing. And soon, moral philosophy got out of the picture. And as a result, we have a bunch of individuals who no longer can think. And as my last remark in the New England Journal of Medicine, Dr. Pellegrino's book on the philosophy of medicine, A New Approach, was reviewed by a physician who said, it was a very nice book, it had a lot of nice things to say. It was unfortunate that he said it in such technical language, which tells me the state of the medical profession, or any profession that limits itself to its own language and doesn't understand what else is being said. And it reminds me of the Tower of Babel. I don't think we have to look at the Old Testament. I think we look at any university structure where one department cannot talk to the other because their terminology is different. because their concepts are different. There's no unification. There's no nexus at which their concepts meet. And I think the time has come that I think that as clergy and as ministers and as attorneys, as human beings, we should have a concept of the humanities.
We can take a few moments for questions this morning. Please remember that we can meet here again at 7:30 tonight. I guess maybe I'm going to adopt your epitaph, Doctor. The one I've been working with goes something like this. See, I told you I was sick. So, are there any questions, comments? Yes, sir.
Can I save that for tonight? I hate to answer that in 2 minutes. I'm very loquacious. Are you going to be here this evening? I haven't seen the schedule either.
7:30.
Well, in natural law, how do I... All right. Now, I think we get into the point of metaethics and logical positivism to define terms. I think natural law says what is the essence of something, okay? And from that something, certain logical values must follow. Now I used, and I'm trying to make this brief, I said a tree has more than a bark and a leaf, a tree has an essence. We have an essence. The essence is our material being, our spiritual being, and our interactive being. Okay? And I use natural law in saying that as a consequence of that, there are certain things that come about that I think anything that is created or anything that is in being shall be respected for because it has a value of its own. And in respecting that value, I have certain obligations and duties. I shall not harm that unless there is a purpose. For example, parts of a tree are there. If I respect that tree, I shall use that tree only as necessary for my survival or the survival of society. I shall not use it for greedy survival like the lumber barons of Wisconsin when they came in and plowed everything down. I am responsible for the essence of the earth. I don't know if I'm getting across to you. I'm trying to be very applicable as to how I use natural law. How do you use it? May I ask you? Yes, I'd like to learn something, too.
Well, natural law, at least the way I use it, has...
God has created. Therefore, I am obedient. I have to be obedient to God as a creature. We haven't been created by God. I've got to love my brother in a true sense. Oh, the first one has been violated. And each and every one follows. The Decalogue, you know, I hate to use it, like Singer did in his book called Practical Ethics. It reminds me of when Giordano Bruno went to Oxford. Singer's from Oxford. He said he couldn't teach over there because most of them are too pedantic to learn. And I read Singer's book on ethics, and I'm kind of lost. He's drifting in a sea without a. See, we're lucky as Christians. We got a moor. We got a good, strong mooring.
Looking at the clock, and since Dr. Ladaraca will be here this evening also, I think we will say thank you for now, Doctor. The crowd is dribbling away, and that's because they're hungry for physical food likewise. Thank you very much, and I hope and pray that we will be able to share the evening with you. Shall we rise once more and welcome...